Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Hello, welcome to the World Book Club, where once a month a leading author joins us to answer questions from an audience and sent in by BBC listeners about one of their best-loved books. And this month, our special guest, here to talk about his extraordinary novel, The Remains of the Day, is the multiply prize-winning Kazuo Ishiguro. Kazuo Ishiguro, welcome to the World Book Club.
Well, very nice to be here.
When I say you're multiply prize-winning, you've also got awards for your services to literature generally from pretty well every... well, France, Italy, from this country, certainly. And I just wonder, where do you keep all the medals and ribbons and statuettes you must have?
Well, most of these are usually kind of metaphorical. I mean, you don't get things. You know, even with the Booker Prize, I don't have any kind of Booker Prize as such.
Kazuo Ishiguro was born in Nagasaki in Japan. And although he was only 5 when he moved to live in England, his first two novels, A Pale View of Hills and An Artist of the Floating World, were very much concerned with Japan's recent history. But The Remains of the Day, on the surface at least, is quintessentially British. Published in 1989 and the winner of that year's Booker Prize for Fiction, The Remains of the Day is the story of an elderly English butler called Stevens, who, in the mid-1950s, is driving sedately across southwest England to meet a woman who once worked with him as a housekeeper. As Stevens drives, he ruminates on the question of what makes a great butler, a great servant in charge of a household. But through his ruminations, there begin to slither darker, more troubling concerns. Gradually, we realise that Stevens' late employer was a Nazi-sympathising aristocrat who plotted to keep Britain out of World War II, and that Stevens' relationship with the one-time housekeeper isn't all it seems. So gracefully and cruelly does the novel twist into tragedy that it's gripped the imagination of readers in more than 30 languages and been made into a major film with Anthony Hopkins and Emma Thompson. But I think, Kazuo Ishiguro, it's now time to meet Stevens himself. And I wonder if you'd read from the book. It's a passage where he is pondering the importance of dignity to butlers.
And let me now posit this. Dignity has to do crucially with a butler's ability not to abandon the professional being he inhabits. Lesser butlers will abandon their professional being for the private one at the least provocation. For such persons, being a butler is like playing some pantomime role. A small push, a slight stumble, and the facade will drop off to reveal the actor underneath. The great butlers are great by virtue of their ability to inhabit their professional role and inhabit it to the utmost. They will not be shaken out by external events, however surprising, alarming, or vexing. They wear their professionalism as a decent gentleman will wear his suit. He will not let ruffians or circumstances tear it off him in the public gaze. He will discard it when, and only when, he wills to do so, and this will invariably be when he is entirely alone. It is, as I say, a matter of dignity.
Kazuo Ishiguro, thank you very much for that. And our first question from a BBC listener comes from Asansol in West Bengal in India. And it's from Shamana Mukherjee, and she is on the telephone now to ask it. Shamana, go ahead.
Okay. My questions to you, sir, are, why did you choose this subject for your book, and why did you choose an elderly butler as one of your characters?
So, big questions. Why this subject for the book, and why an elderly butler?
Well, I'll say one thing. I didn't start off by thinking to myself I wanted to write a book about a butler. I tend to start off with themes and questions. And I'd already written a book set in an entirely different setting in Japan, examining what happens to somebody who gives his best, what he thinks is his best, to his work and his career, that he sees as a kind of vocation, only to find at the end of his life that Because perhaps he didn't have an extraordinary perspective on his times, he has actually contributed to something at best worthless and possibly evil. I was fascinated for a long time with what happens when the social values in a country do a kind of topsy-turvy, leaving a whole generation stranded, morally almost. And I wanted to examine that same question again in the context of English society in the remains of the day. And so, and why did I choose an elderly butler? Well, it seemed to me a butler was, for me at that time, it struck me as a perfect metaphor for the relationship of ordinary people to political power. In many ways, I thought we were all butlers, in a sense, that most of us weren't presidents of countries or heads of vast corporations. We, most of us, do our little jobs, and we try and take a sense of meaning and indeed dignity from how well we do these little jobs, and we serve up our little contribution to somebody upstairs, an organization, a boss, perhaps a cause. And we often don't have much of a control over what we contribute to, you know, because we live on a small scale. And so I thought by looking at a butler who works for his master, who he believes is a great man, I thought would be a very good way of examining this relationship between most of us ordinary people to where the power really lies.
Does that tally with your reading of the book, Shamana?
Yes, yes, it does.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that question. This question was sent in by Takehiko Ohama in Tokyo, in Japan. Hello, Kazuo. I'm a Japanese physician attending English literature classes at the British Council in Tokyo. The dignity of Mr. Stevens put me in mind of a host in the Japanese tea ceremony who is unapproachable and respects the formalities. So I don't agree with your idea that butlers only truly exist in England because there is a lot in common between the English and the Japanese. And I guess the implicit question is, don't you agree?
Well, of course, I mean, the person who says that only, butlers only exist in England, that's Stevens, that's not me. As I've just said, I think there are butlers, we're all butlers in some sense. Yes, I think there are peculiar things that link the English and the Japanese, and they've become quite pertinent with a novel like this. I think there are stereotypes that are common to both.
Such as?
What in England would be called the stiff upper lip. I think there is a fairly strong equivalent of that in Japanese society. Both societies dislike showy displays of emotion. Having grown up as a Japanese boy, if you like, growing up in the heart of the English home counties, I was perhaps peculiarly tuned in to find the parallels between these two kinds of upbringings.
Well, Takehiko Ohama also says, I love the scene of the sun setting over the sea in Weymouth, which reminds me of a haiku, a short poem, by the Japanese poet Basho. And quite a number of BBC listeners have been interested in the landscape in this novel. We have a question here from Buenos Aires in Argentina from Neil McMahon, and he telephoned it in, but we recorded it earlier.
Yeah, hello, Mr. Shigeru. I've actually read the book twice. I really enjoyed it both times. And I was wondering, why did you choose the places that Stevens goes to on his trip through the English countryside in the southwest? And also whether those places had any personal significance for you as a writer?
I have to emphasise that it's a very mythical kind of England that I've tried to create here. It's a kind of a paradox that to write a book that might appeal internationally, I wanted to choose a kind of a mythical England that people understood, could tune into all around the world. And I think regardless of whether people have been to England or not, people all around the world do have a certain image about the English landscape and what kind of place it is. And of course, a lot of that is built up of tourism cliches and so on. But also they are atmospheres and images that come from English literature and to some extent from cinema and drama and so on. I think perhaps as a result of this, it's easier for people all over the world who've never been to England to feel in some way that they know this landscape. But it's a false one. It's there for my purposes.
Thank you. Well, now, questions from the audience here in the World Book Club studio. The gentleman in the front here.
It seems to me that one of the major themes in this novel, and indeed all your work, is the way in which memory operates. I was just wondering what inspired your interest in this topic.
To be absolutely honest, it started off purely as a technical device. If I used a narrator sifting through memories, I managed to write a different kind of book You could put a scene that happened, let's say 1930, you know, right next to a scene that's happening in 1950, you know, or whatever. You have this kind of fluidity. You're not locked into a way of telling the story. But what I became interested in was why this person would put this one particular memory next to this other thing, or why something that was happening in the present would trigger off a particular memory. It's that relationship between these different memories and these different events that are going on in the people's minds. It's that interested me. If you look at memory, you're really looking at how people construct a sense of themselves. I find it fascinating.
Well, one memory that Stevens the butler puts off having, if you like, until quite late in the book, concerns a period in the 1930s when his employer says to him, we're going to have to get rid of two Jewish maids. It's shortly before the war, but he's already decided that he doesn't want Jewish maids in the house. He asks Stevens to do this, and Stevens passes the message on to Miss Kenton, since it's her job to get rid of the maids, over one of their sort of regular cups of cocoa in the evening. And I wonder if you would read from the moment at which he's asked her to do this.
At this point, Miss Kenton seemed to have nothing to say in response. So I continued, well, Miss Kenton, thank you for the cocoa. It's high time I was turning in. Another busy day tomorrow. It was then, Miss Kenton said, Mr. Stevens, I cannot quite believe my ears. Ruth and Sarah have been members of my staff for over 6 years now. I trust them absolutely, and indeed they trust me. They have served this house excellently. I am sure that is so, Miss Kenton. However, we must not allow sentiment to creep into our judgment. Now, really, I must bid you good night. Mr. Stevens, I am outraged that you can sit there and utter what you have just done, as though you were discussing orders for the larder. I simply cannot believe it. You are saying Ruth and Sarah are to be dismissed on the grounds that they are Jewish? Miss Kenton, I have just this moment explained the situation to you fully. His lordship has made his decision, and there is nothing for you and I to debate over. Does it not occur to you, Mr. Stevens, that to dismiss Ruth and Sarah on these grounds would simply be wrong? I will not stand for such things. I will not work in a house in which such things can occur.
Well, it's a good chilling moment, and one of the ironies is that Miss Kenton indeed does continue to work in a house in which such things can occur. And we've got a question now from a BBC listener from Harare in Zimbabwe, and his question bears some relation to that episode. He's called Michael Hartnack, and he's on the telephone now to ask it.
I wondered whether you'd like to comment, as someone who came in from the outside and looked at the English class system. I wondered to what extent you felt that people who were trapped in the English class system, like the servants, were very much like the functionaries of the 1930s totalitarian states, who abandoned their individual moral responsibility and pleaded to themselves, at least, that they were just obeying orders.
Interesting idea. Was that a parallel between the functionaries of totalitarian states who said, I was just obeying orders?
I can see the parallels there, and I think that's a very interesting parallel you raise. The point that you make is that perhaps there is a parallel at that precise point when someone abandons moral and political responsibility. The English class system, I think, is fascinating, but I have a feeling it works, the mechanisms are quite different.
Michael Hartnack, I get the impression from your question that you read The Remains of the Day very much as a political parable.
To an extent, yes, and I wondered to what extent the author was still baffled by the class system in England as someone who came in from the outside and looked at it.
You don't have to be an outsider to be baffled by it, but Kazuo Ishiguro.
I do find it baffling. I should explain that I grew up in England from the age of five, which is when I came from Japan, being brought up by Japanese parents in full expectation that we would return to Japan the following year. Now, every year we were going to go back the following year. And so that meant that inside of my home, we kind of behaved in a Japanese way. You know, we didn't have the mentality of immigrants who said, we are now in this society, we better adopt the values of this society. And I would say my parents grew up with a kind of a very benevolent interest in the ways of the natives of Britain. And indeed, the British class system was one of these things that they would often remark on. But I'm tempted to say that although, yes, this book involves servants and their employers. I've never been that interested in class. As I was suggesting earlier on, most ordinary citizens have that sort of relationship to the people who really wield influence and power. And it's that relationship that I'm interested in here in The Remains Today, rather than specifically the English class system.
Michael Hartnack, thank you very much for that question. Next question comes in an email from Susan Kondo in Japan, who writes, there seems to be a theme running through Mr. Ishiguro's work, not only The Remains of the Day, concerning the frailty or personal nature of truth. The main characters perceive themselves, their relationships and situations in ways that are shown in each novel to differ, sometimes radically, from how other people see them. This is such a prevalent theme in Mr. Ishiguro's work that I wonder what prompts it.
I'm probably not that interested in what really happens in my novels. I'm much more interested in what people think happened, you know, what the characters think happened, and their struggle with the different versions of what happened. So in a book like The Remains of the Day, I don't ultimately care that much as a writer, you know, what really took place, for objectively speaking, for Stevens, you know, back in those days. I'm much more concerned about what Stevens tells himself happened. Typically, he'll come up with different ideas about why he behaved in a certain way, and he'll revise that opinion several pages later. It's that whole process of struggling with your memories, trying to make one version take precedence over another version, to try and find some place where you feel comfortable with what happened and in the past and what you did and how you acted. My stories don't really depend on what happened. They depend more on what people say happened, what people tell themselves happened.
Well, I have a question now from Gerard Nsengiyumva from Kigali in Rwanda. He wants to know this. I'm interested to know whether Kazuo Ishiguro thinks about how his books are received in different countries and cultures.
Yes, I do, and I worry about that. I mean, what I mean is that I worry too much about this question. Until my generation, that's to say, I'm now nearly 50. The generation of writers just before me, I have a feeling they didn't worry quite so much about their audience. They tended to write for an English audience, if they were English writers. But I think from my generation onwards, we're very aware that novels can travel all around the world. And I think this...
You find it a pressure rather than a kind of opening up.
It's probably an unconscious pressure, but let me put it this way. After I finish a book, my various publishers around the world make me go around the world. Now, you just picture this. There I am, say, let's say, in Denmark. Okay, and I spend a week, you know, talking about a particular book that I have written to Danes. And sometimes the Danes will be puzzled. You know, there are certain things in this book that I thought would be absolutely clear to an English person, but they're slightly puzzled, you know. Maybe it's to do with the humour, maybe it's a specific reference. The book is also translated into another language. So some things that perhaps work very well in the English language work differently in the Danish language. Now, when I come home and I'm writing again, a different book, I can't help somewhere at the back of my mind thinking about these Danes. You know, these Danes... These Danes are looking over my shoulder. Now, that's what I mean by the pressure. Somewhere at the back of my mind, I know when I write a line, I have to kind of run it past these Danes as well.
And you're so widely read that there must be a kind of United Nations crowding behind you as you write.
Now, I think there are dangers about writers thinking like this. This isn't an intellectual position I'm taking. I'm just saying this is what happens now. Just as when you broadcast for the World Service, you're very aware of who you're broadcasting to. I think novelists today are much more aware of their audience.
Thank you. Questions for Kazuo Ishiguro from the audience here. Yes, in the front.
I just wanted to know if you base the character of Stevens on any person you've had a past experience with.
Mm. Well, certainly he wasn't based on... I know no real butlers. and I didn't grow up in that kind of England at all. It's only after I published the book that real butlers started to write to me. as we suggested in the book, I mean, in a way, the butler, as I've created him, is a kind of a monster version of various aspects of normal people. It's tempting to say, I suppose, because I'm the author, that, you know, I've taken certain impulses and emotional aspects of myself and blown them up to some kind of grotesque level and created this monster of the stiff upper lip and emotional restraint, as well as, you know, moral and political naivety. I tend to work like that as a writer. I always take emotional impulses and create characters out of them. My characters don't tend to be kind of three-dimensional in that sense. You know, they're slightly cartoony.
Now, we've had a great many questions from listeners to the BBC World Service, to you, Kazuo Ishiguro, and we're not going to be able to read all of them out, but at least three of them, one from Japan, one from Thailand, and one from Israel, wanted to talk with you about the film. So on the telephone now from Israel, we've got Paula Wyman-Kelman with her version of the question.
Yes, I would really like to know how you felt about having your work turned into film and how you felt about the product.
I thought it would be rather a difficult thing to film because a lot of it is internal monologue, and I didn't quite know how they'll do it. I didn't participate in the film myself. I think the film came out really, really well, and I've always been very proud to be associated with the film. My ambition would be that a good film emerges with the same title as my book. You know? And I don't think an author can look at a film version in the same way that he might look at, say, the French translation or whatever. I mean, it's not a translation. It's another work, you know, and hopefully another work of art. To be honest, yes, I mean, the first few times I saw bits from the film, there were moments of completely irrational upset. I wanted to say, oh, look, this room is the wrong way round. You know? You know, how on earth can you get that wrong? The door should be over there. Then I realized, of course, that was only in my head. You know, and eventually I got used to reading this phrase in newspapers and magazines, which was James Ivory's "The Remains of the Day." Because the first few times I saw this, I thought, "Hey, wait, what's happened?" But after a while, I began to accept that yes, there is this thing called James Ivory's "The Remains of the Day," which is kind of a cousin to my "The Remains of the Day," and they kind of get on quite well together and support each other quite well. And I'm quite happy with that. And I think that's kind of the way I want it to be.
Another question from someone in the audience.
Given what you were saying about us all in some way being butlers, the man at the end who Stephen speaks to, who tells him about the evening being the best part of the day and who makes Stephen think about what to do with the remains of the day, was it important that he was a butler? Was he sort of an alternative way of being?
It's odd. I didn't think very much about that person. I just wanted Stevens to have someone to open up to. I just wanted a moment when Stevens could finally open up to somebody. And I thought he's the kind of person who'd open up to a stranger. To a large extent, I was interested in what happens when people have very, very parochial visions. It's largely because of this that he gets things wrong in his life. And he can't really see. He's quite myopic, morally. But for this reason, I thought it was only conceivable that he would open up to somebody who was a butler. I mean, somebody who wasn't part of that world. I mean, he would just assume wouldn't understand what he was talking about. He wouldn't register with him as a proper human being. So I thought, yes, he should be a butler. And the fact that he is a fellow butler meant that he felt that kind of kinship.
Well, our final question comes from a Japanese student, Ayuko Hiramatsu, who writes, "I'm curious. What's the life of a writer like? I think they cannot be indifferent to anything because of their job. Everything in our life could be a source of their work. I have a particular image, sitting at the desk all day, long in their study, fighting alone, cutting themselves off from everything which annoys them, even their families. Have you ever thought that you might sacrifice your family because of your profession? I hope I'm not being rude to you."
Well, once again, over the years, I've got to know many writers, and people seem to work very differently. I think the writers who are most in danger of sacrificing their families are the people who base characters in their novels on family members. I think you literally lose your family doing that. Personally, I find it works very well because I'm at home a lot of the time, and certainly in the context of British society at the moment, most of the people I know who live around me, they're never home. They're having to work so hard and commute such long distances, and there seems to be no family life. It's very difficult to fit that into the professional life, and I feel in a way rather privileged in that I can work from home and be quite flexible about my work. But what I'd like to say is that a writer's life these days it isn't quite that, you know, it's locking yourself away in the room. I think there is a very public side to being a writer. And this has really grown, I would say, in the last 15 years or so because of the marketing of books. And it's a very strange existence because I typically might spend 3 years quite relatively secluded. Yes, I'll see friends and family and so on, but I'm in my little study, you know, writing away. And then you give your book in. And then I might spend up to 2 years being a kind of salesman going around the world, just flogging this book. And there you, it's like a second job. You are a very public figure. You're doing events. You're going, you know, you're talking on radio shows or TV shows and facing theatre audiences and so on in, you know, all around the world. But increasingly, a writer is becoming more like people in film or pop stars or whatever. You are expected to have a public side to your life.
Well, that's all the questions we've got time for. Next month, our special guest will be the Brazilian author Paulo Coelho talking about his massive bestseller, The Alchemist. And coming up soon, British author Zadie Smith will be answering questions about her ambitious tale of multicultural London, White Teeth. If you'd like to put a question to Zadie Smith, there's still time. Post it to me at World Book Club, BBC World Service, Bush House, London, or you can email it to worldbookclub@bbc.co.uk. World Book Club, all one word, at bbc.co.uk. And please remember to tell us where you're writing from. And if you'd like to ask your question directly on the telephone, we need to know your number. But for now, thank you to the audience here in the World Book Club studio. Thank you to you, the listeners. And thanks especially to this month's guest, Kazuo Ishiguro.
There are dozens of different podcasts now available from the BBC, including news, documentaries, science, business, arts and sport. For details of them all, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.